Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. We have a very important news-focused interview for you today with Dr. Donald Abrams. Last week, there was a breakthrough study, the first in decades, to investigate the potential for whole smoked cannabis to be used to treat a specific medical condition. Conducted at the San Francisco General Hospital with the University of California's Pain Clinical Research Center and the University of California's Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research, the study is entitled Cannabis in Painful HIV-Associated Sensory Neuropathy, and it appears this month in the journal Neurology. We have links to the study on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Dr. Donald Abrams led the team in this study. Dr. Abrams has worked as an HIV and AIDS caregiver and is now focused on cancer care. He joins us today from San Francisco via phone. Dr. Abrams, thank you for taking time to speak with us here on the Audio Stash today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you again, Doctor, for taking time to join us here today. There's been a lot of interest surrounding this study around the country. Now, this wasn't the first time that you investigated smoked cannabis with HIV patients. There was a study looking at the safety of smoking marijuana for HIV patients you conducted in the past. So first, tell us a bit about that earlier safety study.
We did a study 1998 to 2000 in patients with HIV who were on protease inhibitor therapies, the antiretroviral drug that became really part of the potent regimens that we began to use in about 1996. That study actually grew out of attempts to do studies looking at the potential benefits of smoked cannabis in patients with the HIV wasting syndrome that we started in about 1992, trying to get that approved. By 1996, with the availability of protease inhibitors, the wasting syndrome itself disappeared. It was one of the late stages of HIV infection. Protease inhibitors, as you know, sort of resurrected people with HIV, so nobody got to those late stages again, and there was no need to investigate smoked marijuana for the wasting syndrome anymore. But protease inhibitors are broken down by the same pathway in the liver that breaks down many other drugs and many other recreational substances, if you will. There was a report of a death in somebody who did ecstasy and ritonavir, one of the protease inhibitors. So when it became clear that cannabis and its components were also broken down by the same liver pathways, we decided that it would be important to do a study demonstrating that it was safe for people with HIV on protease inhibitors to smoke cannabis, to make sure that there was no interaction between the cannabinoids and the protease inhibitors, as well as to make sure that there was no interaction between cannabis and the immune system. Many people are concerned that cannabis may suppress immunity and that this would be another reason why patients with HIV should avoid it. So the primary endpoint in that 21-day study was what happens to the HIV virus in the bloodstream, with the thought being that if there was some negative interaction with the antiviral drugs and cannabis, that we might lose the benefit of the antiviral, or if there was some negative interaction with cannabis and the immune system, we might lose the control of the virus as well. So in addition to just looking at cannabis, we decided we should also look at oral THC, dronabinol or marinol, and then since we didn't think it would be useful to have people inhaling three times a day a placebo, we did use a placebo marinol capsule. So that was a three-arm study where one-third of the patients got placebo marinol, one-third got 2.5 milligrams of marinol three times a day, and one-third smoked a cannabis cigarette from NIDA three times a day. What we found was that there was no interaction between the cannabinoids, either oral or smoked, and the protease inhibitors that was clinically significant. We saw no change in the level of HIV virus over 21 days in the patients, and if anything, we saw some sort of intriguing potential improvement in the immune system in those patients receiving cannabinoids, both in the levels of the CD4 helper T lymphocytes, the cells that usually get destroyed by HIV, as well as in the levels of the CD8 suppressor lymphocytes, the cells that suppress virally infected cells. So that was pretty intriguing. We saw no evidence of damage to the immune system. And we concluded that cannabis over the short term, this was only a 21-day study, and using NIDA cannabis, which is relatively low potency, was safe in patients with HIV on protease inhibitors.
So now, knowing it was safe for HIV patients to smoke marijuana, your most recent study, really again the first in decades to be conducted here in the U.S., on how smoked cannabis can be used to treat a specific medical condition, in this case, HIV-associated neuropathy. Dr. Abrams, tell us how these patients experience this neuropathy.
Neuropathic pain is damage to nerve endings, usually in the feet, also sometimes in the hands. And it's a burning sensation or a tingling or a numbness or actually a sharp pain for some patients. It varies from patient to patient. The cause of it is either from HIV itself infecting the nerves or from some of the earlier drugs that we used in the treatment of HIV, particularly the dideoxynucleosides, DDI, DDC, and D4T. They were all related with nerve damage, probably by damage to the mitochondria, the energy-producing organelles in the cells. It's felt that about a third of the patients with HIV will experience neuropathy at some point during their life. Neuropathy is also very common in diabetics, and also patients receiving chemotherapy can develop neuropathic pain. So we only studied HIV in this particular trial because those are patients that I have access to as an HIV care provider. We don't know if the findings from our study could be extrapolated to patients with other sorts of neuropathic syndromes. We were able to study this because of the creation of the University of California Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research. In general, the National Institute on Drug Abuse is mandated by Congress only to supply cannabis for research studies looking at its safety, not as its potential to be a therapy, because Congress says that substances of abuse should be studied only as substances of abuse by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So with the creation of the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research at the University of California in 1999, we had the opportunity to get funding to support studies looking at the potential medical effectiveness of smoked cannabis. And this study is the first of the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research studies to reach fruition and be published.
We're with Dr. Donald Abrams of San Francisco's General Hospital. He led a study funded by the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research at the University of California investigating neuropathic pain reduction through smoked cannabis with HIV patients. Dr. Abrams, before this study, was a reduction in HIV patients' neuropathic pain something that was anecdotally reported by those living with HIV and AIDS when they smoked marijuana.
Yeah, there's been preclinical evidence in animal studies that cannabis may be useful in neuropathic pain models, things that they do in mice and rats, for example, that simulate the picture of neuropathic pain in humans. And, you know, certainly we have had anecdotal reports over the years of patients saying that, you know, gee, when I smoke cannabis, my neuropathic pain is better. We also did, prior to the randomized placebo-controlled trial, a 16-patient open-label study in which all the participants were prescribed smoke cannabis, no placebo, so that we can assess, number one, whether it worked, and number two, if it did work, what the effect size was, so that we could calculate then the sample size for the randomized placebo-controlled trial.
And, Doctor, when we talk about using smoked marijuana for pain reduction here, do the other drugs that are commonly prescribed for neuropathy in HIV patients react somewhat badly with the regimen of other life-saving drugs that they're having to take every day?
In fact, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and opioids don't work, really, in neuropathic pain in studies that have been conducted. Antidepressants were tried for some time. And subsequently, most people have settled on using an anticonvulsant or anti-seizure medicine, gabapentin or Neurontin, as the drug of first choice. Some people tolerate it, some people don't, and, you know, there's always a potential for some kind of a drug-drug interaction between anything that we prescribe and patients' antiretroviral drugs.
Now, Doctor, this study found a greater than 30% reduction in pain over the course of the five-day study with the patients who received about 4% THC marijuana to smoke three times daily. Is this study enough now to move forward and say this is an effective pain therapy for HIV-associated neuropathy and that HIV patients around the country could explore it as a treatment option?
So I am not the pain specialist, but I worked with experts from our pain clinical research center, and they told me that many pain drugs are approved if they show a greater than 20% reduction in pain. We chose greater than 30% to set the bar high because we knew we were dealing with inhaled cannabis and that this was a slightly controversial substance. So we said for any person to have success, they needed to achieve greater than 30% reduction in their neuropathic pain. What we saw was over 50% of the patients smoking the active cannabis achieved that 30% reduction compared to less than a quarter of the patients smoking cannabis. Overall, the pain reduction in the cannabis group was 34% compared to 17% in the placebo group. What I think is most interesting is that concomitant with the analysis of the effect of smoked cannabis on the patient's neuropathic pain, we also questioned what it did to an experimental pain that we induced in the patient by heating their skin and then rubbing capsaicin cream on it. And this was an experimental pain model was really something that could not be influenced by bias because patients, you know, couldn't say, oh, well, I might be smoking marijuana, so I'm going to say that my neuropathic pain is better, but they would not know how to bias the results of this very much more objective analysis that we did of experimental pain. And what really was very gratifying for us was the sort of overlapping responses that we saw in both the patient's chronic neuropathic pain and the experimental pain model.
Now, Doctor, you mentioned before that you had looked at isolated THC and synthetic THC in the case of Marinol, but is there some idea here that it is whole smoked cannabis that really offers the best benefit because of the variety of natural cannabinoids that are being introduced here?
Well, I think you hit it on the head there that, you know, Delta-9 THC is just an isolated cannabinoid, and there are many other cannabinoids in the plant. In addition, there are also terpenoids and flavonoids in the plant, which in and of themselves may have some benefit, if not for neuropathy, for other conditions, in that there are anti-inflammatory and antioxidant activities in some of the other plant compounds that we don't benefit from when we're just taking an isolated component and synthetically putting it in sesame oil or whatever.
And Dr. Abrams, you are based there in San Francisco, an area that has embraced Proposition 215 and medical marijuana access. Was it that alone that has made this research possible? And if not, what did it take to open up this realm of important research there?
No, it wasn't just Proposition 215. That occurred in 1996. It was the work of Senator John Vasconcellos, who was at that time a state senator, who said, okay, well, now we're saying that doctors can talk to patients about use of medicinal cannabis in these conditions. Maybe we should study it to see if it really works. And so he, in 1999, put up legislation which allowed for the appropriation of $3 million a year for 3 years to support a Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research, which was established at the University of California. Now, unfortunately, there is no continuing appropriation because our state finances have changed a bit from 7 or 8 years ago. So the center has basically funded all the trials that they could fund at this point in time. But, yes, it is the establishment of that center to fund efficacy trials to look at the potential effectiveness of smoked cannabis that allows us in California to do this research. And again, the National Institute on Drug Abuse then developed a mechanism whereby they could supply government marijuana for these studies because they are, as I mentioned, the only legal source of cannabis for doing research. I can't tell you whenever I give a lecture how many people come up to me and say, I'd like to supply your cannabis. I have better marijuana. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. We do live in this, you know, sort of monopoly.
And doctor, being based in California, where again there is legal medical access and working with patients living with HIV and AIDS, I have to ask, have you seen patients directly who have seen some overall benefits to using medical marijuana?
Well, in our first study, the safety study that we did, we asked people to stop smoking for a month before they came into our general clinical research center for 25 days. And we found that the largest single reason that patients chose not to participate in the study was they said they couldn't stop smoking for a month because cannabis was the only thing allowing them to tolerate the mild but disturbing nausea associated with their antiretroviral therapy regimen. So that we know, and that was confirmed in work that Dennis Israelski's group did in Redwood City as well. To be honest, now I've stopped seeing patients with HIV as of last August to concentrate my career on seeing patients with cancer and providing them with integrative medicine consultation to live with and beyond their cancer. But the number of cancer patients that I see for whom cannabis is a very useful drug because it is the only anti-nausea medicine that also increases appetite. And it also decreases pain and decreases anxiety and it helps people sleep. And for some people, it works against constipation as well. So it's one drug that does quite a bit for patients with cancer. And, you know, that side effect of euphoria that some people don't like, I don't think is such a bad thing in people who have a terminal condition.
Dr. Abrams, this has been a wonderful discussion today about this very important research. I want to thank you again for taking time to join us here today. I can't wait to have you back on the program in the future.
My pleasure.
Dr. Donald Abrams led the team conducting a study at the San Francisco General Hospital with the University of California's Clinical Pain Research Center and the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research. The study is entitled Cannabis in Painful HIV-Associated Sensory Neuropathy, and it appears this month in the journal Neurology. We'll have links to the study on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Tomorrow on the Audio Stash, we'll speak with Tom Kajowski of the National Association of People Living with AIDS and Karen Woodson of Americans for Safe Access about those two groups' combined efforts seeking medical marijuana access around the country for Americans living with HIV and AIDS. You can visit our website again for more information at normalaudiostash.com.
No. big picture of the human race. A perfect picture of the human race. All you can label this poor flotsam of humanity is shame. Shame on every hand.
Shall I kill?
That was some fine music found at podshow.com. We have links to all the artists at normalaudiostash.com. Wednesdays here on the Audio Stash, we get the chance to discuss the science of cannabis with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. Mitch is also the editor of a new book out there, Pot Politics. And we have links to those fine volumes at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, welcome back to the program today.
Thank you, Chris.
Great to have you back on the program. As always, Mitch, we're highlighting data today that was included in the Normal Weekly press release last week. And that's this study from New Haven, Connecticut on pulmonary function in smoking marijuana. Now, the data did show some effects, but certainly not anything particularly threatening to overall health. Mitch, first, let's go over this data about the short-term effects from smoking marijuana. What did they find here?
Well, the recurring theme for short-term effects is that marijuana causes bronchodilation. Basically, your capillaries in the bronchial tract and your lungs and all of those areas open up during marijuana smoking, which is part of why some asthma sufferers suggest marijuana has helped them with some of their respiratory symptoms. But it also creates a rough situation for the storage of tar or any other nasty things that might be in smoke, because your lungs are now extra dilated. Any tars or basically potential carcinogens seems like they'd have a bigger opportunity to hook on to the lungs under those circumstances.
And because they compare tobacco smoking and tobacco smoke so many times in the text of this study to cannabis smoke, I have to ask, Mitch, is that same type of bronchodilation, is that something that happens with smoking tobacco?
It's curious because nicotine doesn't seem to be as strong a bronchodilator and may actually decrease the size of capillaries in the lungs under other circumstances. And, you know, that creates its own set of problems as well, but it's just not the same. And, of course, you know, nobody would recommend tobacco smoke as a treatment for asthma.
Now, Mitch, last year there was this very comprehensive and important study from Dr. Donald Tashkin that showed no increased risk to marijuana smokers, even in the long term, for lung cancer specifically. But this report that we're talking about today really focused on other problems in the lungs. So based on this data, is there any long-term physiological harm happening from smoking marijuana?
The things that seem to show up are the coughing and wheezing and phlegm production that show up study after study. And it's not a huge effect, but basically you're about twice as likely to report having a cough if you're a regular cannabis user than if you are not. But what also was surprising to me is that all these measures of airflow and some very objective respiratory function measures, where you blow into something as fast as you can, as hard as you can, none of those seem to show consistent impairment. And when they went ahead and averaged it across all the studies, they found really there isn't a significant effect on some very objective and intriguing measures of respiratory function. And that in some ways is kind of reassuring, that although there may be some increase in coughing and phlegm and wheezing, it's not manifesting itself in the things that are usually associated with cystic fibrosis or any of the really nasty late-stage tobacco smoking respiratory problems.
And let's explore that a bit more, especially in relation to tobacco again. That's one test you mentioned, having to blow into this device as fast as you can. That's something tobacco cigarette smokers have particular problems with when tested. So here we sort of see that cannabis smoking is a bit less detrimental to lung health overall than tobacco smoking.
And in fact, folks who smoke the combination seem to be at increased risk for some of these respiratory symptoms as well. So I can say wholeheartedly that smoking cigarettes is really bad for you, and the combination of marijuana and cigarettes can be particularly bad, markedly worse than marijuana alone, and a good step worse from tobacco alone.
All this really seems to be more along the lines of minor irritation rather than something life-threatening per se, but the lungs are going to get irritated from anything but air. Is that right?
The lungs evolved to breathe clean air. I mean, it's really just not part of our design. And in fact, this is my usual rant about the vaporizer. As you can decrease the particulate matter in what you inhale, of course you're going to be healthier. Although the risks aren't huge here for marijuana smokers, that coughing and wheezing and phlegm is a bit of a hassle and, you know, can't be really good for you in the long run. Although if it were carcinogenic, we would have found it by now, and the Tashkent data suggests that this may not lead to lung cancer. In fact, because of some of the protective effects of THC that Bob Malamede has discussed on the show before. But it's still, you know, not good for you to be coughing and wheezing all the time, and a switch to a vaporizer could be really adaptive for regular cannabis users.
And again, just to be clear here, it seems that coughing and wheezing are definitely lung irritations happening, but not some indicator of emphysema or some bigger problem like that.
In fact, with some of these studies that are in the review, the folks had been smoking for literally over a decade. And so if there were going to be some second-stage emphysema, you know, some of the beginnings of the real intractable problems that can't be reversed in emphysema, we would have seen them in those studies, and it just doesn't seem to be there. And that's when you start seeing this, the force that somebody can exhale gets impaired, or the amount of air they can hold in their lungs starts getting impaired, and that's just not showing up in a consistent fashion.
Mitch, the data reviewed in this study truly goes back decades, so I have to wonder, is there any drug that we so rigorously test and review for long-term safety like this? I mean, this study, again, really seems to look along the lines of general safety of smoked marijuana, but do we test and scrutinize anything else like this over time, even things like opiates or ibuprofen?
I don't think they have quite the history either. So some of these studies in this review go back before many of our listeners were born. There's some in the 1970s when some of these questions were first initiated. And I do feel like, you know, a lot of pharmaceutical drugs do get some close looks when they're being approved, but that a two-year follow-up is about as best as you get on a lot of medications. And here's something where folks are getting followed up a lot longer and still not showing the most detrimental effects. And, you know, how many more chances does cannabis need to prove it's a potentially safe drug? I'm just not sure. I appreciate the interest, and it certainly keeps me busy in my research, but it's sort of a shame that none of this has leaked into policy and that I still have arguments about respiratory effects of cannabis when I'm talking to prohibitionists.
That is interesting. So just to recap, again, this study tells us, yes, there are some short and long-term physiological effects from smoking cannabis, some coughing, some phlegm production, but in the long term, this study and others shows smoking cannabis is really not going to be the singular cause for any disease, even smoking cannabis over the long term.
Well, and I do feel like, you know, these odds ratios of doubling your chance of a cough are not going to be present in the vaporizer users. I have some data under review at Harm Reduction Journal now suggesting that the vaporizer in regular cannabis smokers has the potential to really decrease these symptoms and may even help for, God forbid, those who haven't quit smoking cigarettes yet, which the whole idea of reducing harm for cigarettes is extremely controversial, but certainly the combination of marijuana and cigarettes seems to be less severe among those who actually use a vaporizer with their cannabis.
Mitch, this has been another wonderful discussion today. Thank you again for joining us here and sharing your expertise with our audience on Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
This is a favorite topic of mine, and happy to return to it whenever you'd like.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. Mitch is also the editor of the new book Pot Politics, and we have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch joins us each Wednesday here on the program to discuss the science of cannabis. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting Technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.